Well, Tim, you actually start the book. I mean, here we are. We've talked a lot about the president and a lot about just your involvement in the White House and the many things that you got to see. But you actually start the book, and I think it's an interesting way to start the memoir, with a day when you said, you described it as the most beautiful morning, and by evening, probably, you know, what you described as the worst day of your life. Mm-hmm. A day when you took decided to open up an email from a reporter who asked you if you had plagiarized a portion of a column that you'd written for a paper in Indiana, in your hometown. And you basically just responded and said, I did. And then from there, you pretty much knew that a snowball of events would occur, including most likely losing your job. And, you know, I mean, this was all over the papers. It was reported. I mean, a really what you said, you know, you hold up for that weekend pretty much.
Yes.
Just to gather yourself and really apologize to your family and just start what would become a series of events of apologizing to a bunch of folks. And I want you to just kind of highlight that a little bit, especially your feelings going into the Oval Office, feeling, I think you described it as feeling like the hammer was going to come down with the president and what he would have to say, and what did he actually say?
Yeah, well, I'm happy to share this. And I want to offer one prelude, which is one of the chapters is called Fortunate Friendships. And one of the fortunate friendships I had over a long period of time was with William F. Buckley. And Bill Buckley and I became very good friends. We became sailing friends. But
which is also a pretty good account in the book itself of your landlubber experience.
Thank you. He once said to me, and speaking of his time with President Nixon, he said, it's a remarkable thing to be in the Oval Office with the leader of the free world when you're speaking and you noticed that the leader of the free world is taking notes while you're speaking. And I say that because when I was enjoying this extraordinary, remarkable professional position in my life, in fact, it was the job that I would have done if for free if I were a billionaire. I loved my work with George W. Bush. But as I recount, I had gotten a very bad strain of Potomac fever. Mm-hmm. And Potomac fever, for some people, takes the avenue of sex. And some people, it's power, and some people, it's money. With me, it was pride. It was a venal, egotistical pride of wanting to be the clever one, the one who wrote it and said it better than anyone. And so the power of self-deception is very large. And it wasn't pressure or stress. I knew exactly what I was doing. So when I popped open the email, and I, as I describe in the book, I literally fell down next to my desk at the White House. And I said, oh God, because I knew it was true. And I said to the reporter, guilty as charged. And I knew that I would resign that day, and I did. And in the political classes, as you know, Lisa, from your time as reporting in Washington, a kind of divorce takes place when you embarrass the president or the senator or the congressman. You are cut off and persona non grata, and usually right away. And when I left the White House that Friday, that's what I expected my fate to be. When I came in on Monday to take the pictures off the walls and began clearing out my desk, the chief of staff said to me the words that nobody in the White House ever wants to hear: the boss wants to see you. And I expected my proverbial woodshed moment, and I deserved it. I brought this crisis on myself. And at no extenuating circumstances, no excuses, I was 100% at fault. And I embarrassed the president and my family and 20 years of interns, and I could go on and on and on. So I expected this woodshed moment. I went into the Oval Office. It was the president and me. And I closed the door, and I turned to him to apologize. And he looked me directly in the eyes, and he said, Tim, you're forgiven. And I was stunned. And I looked at the president directly in the eyes, and I attempted a second time to apologize. And he said, grace and mercy are real. I've known grace and mercy in my own life, and I'm extending it to you. And I said, Mr. President, you should have taken me by the lapels and tossed me onto Pennsylvania Avenue for what I did. I said, I am so sorry. And he said, I'll say a third time. Forgiveness, grace, and mercy are real. I'm extending it to you. I've known it in my own life. and we can talk about all of this, or we can talk about the last 8 years. Now, by this moment, it was all very surreal. And I turned around to go sit on the couch, one of the two couches. And he said, no, come over here. And he asked me to sit in the place of honor where the vice president or a visiting dignitary sits below the famous portrait of George Washington. We spoke about the last 8 years, two hard-fought campaigns for the presidency. By that time, I had been one of his longest-serving aides. We prayed together, and I recount in the book, looking around the Oval Office and feeling a kind of melancholy that I had never felt. It was all surreal what had just happened, but I really felt as the grandson of an immigrant that I had really let my grandfather down, because only in the United States, within a generation or two, could you rise to a position like I had. And I knew that that was the last time I would see the president or the Oval Office, and et cetera. And as I was leaving, he turned to me and said, and by the way, I want you to bring your wife and children here so I can tell them what a great father and husband you've been. And by this point, I was truly stunned. And sure enough, in a few days, my wife and boys came back. And I've seen the president several times since. I consider us to be friends. He wrote me a wonderful note about the book. And I have to say, this is elementally who George W. Bush is. And again, in things that are very personal like this, but in very large things, which I write about in the book, it all stems from his faith.
First of all, we know that everyone sins every day. And as believers, we're supposed to be aware of that. And we're supposed to be aware of grace. And obviously, very few people sin and then have it become public and have it end up in the papers and have it. But the fact is, we're all sinners. But many people could say, oh, you know, Tim, all this talk about grace. I mean, you're a Christian. You should understand grace. You should know that. But to have grace given in such a public and shaming and whatever you want to call it forum is probably life-changing. And I want to just know from you, Tim, how did your faith change after that series of events? You just talked about being so overwhelmed by the fact that, you know, your wife and your sons are like, of course, we forgive you. Now let's go, you know, and of course, all the way up to the president and the many others, friends who called you and said, I'm behind you. I want to pray for you. How did your faith change, or how has it changed since then?
Redemption, I learned, is a process. Forgiveness is a process. Grace and mercy are real. They're as real as the fact that we're sitting in a radio studio recording this interview. But I really do believe that though forgiveness and grace and mercy are real, that repentance is the heart of it. It's not just an acknowledgement that what I did was deceptive and wrong, but it was a sense of repentance, which then takes you forward. You know, one of the things that I did not recount in the book, and in retrospect maybe could have and should have, is a moment that I had with my pastor where we actually go into the sanctuary of our church and where I knelt down on the altar and had a sense of confession and real absolving of what I had done. And it's when you internalize your sin that you're really most horrified by what you've done. You know, there are people listening, Lisa, who have had crises in their life. Some crises are the kind where a tornado hits your house or things that are fully beyond your control. In my instance, it was my own sin and bad actions, you know? So the thing that I have learned and really learned is that forgiveness and redemption are real, but they can't be given and appreciated in a sort of snapshot moment of time. It takes time. And that's an important part of the Christian life, to move forward and to move in a different direction.
Hmm. All right, last question. You have met and are... but you've met throughout your life extraordinary people. We've talked about some of them, senators, congressmen, the president of the United States, several other presidents, Ronald Reagan, you met him. We didn't even talk about that. Bill Buckley, people that you call friends who we see on the TV. What makes a person extraordinary?
Humility. My favorite poet is T.S. Eliot, who I consider to be the greatest poet of the 20th century. He famously wrote what I consider to be the three most beautiful words in the English language. He said, humility is endless. And I believe that's true. I begin The Man in the Middle with a verse from Proverbs 11 that essentially says that pride does go before a fall. And I twin that with a very beautiful quote from one of my favorite writers, G.K. Chesterton. Among many of the things, he wrote a series of novels called The Father Brown Mysteries. And Chesterton says, you know, the temptation is to think that when you're at the height of the mountain, that then you're really seeing the best view. That's pride. He said it's the opposite. He said it's when you're in the valley that you have the greatest vista. You know, being here in Colorado Springs, and especially, you know, coming from Washington, you know, I never fail to be dazzled by the magnificence and the luminosity of the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains and the and Pikes Peak. And I think that that's what Chesterton meant. And so in my view, if you want to really understand greatness in any human being, whether they're really famous or they're not a person who will be, you know, perhaps remembered much beyond their lifetime, the one common narrative that I have found is this real spirit of genuine humility, because I think it is the heart of Jesus Christ.
And that it is, and very difficult to find and to express and to see expressed, and especially, you know, when pressed or in difficult times. So, all right. Tim Gagline, a friend to us, certainly here at Focus on the Family, a friend to me since I've met him now several times, and author of The Man in the Middle, the book that we've been talking about, but also just a great co-worker here at Focus on the Family and the many things that you're doing out there in D.C. and beyond as you travel to and fro, and we're always privileged when you can pop by the Boundless Studios and chat with us for a bit. So,
well, I appreciate that very much, and it gives me the opportunity to say what I really believe, which is I have been a fan of Boundless for many, many years, and I have, because of the book, done many interviews by now, and I can say without exception that once again, this is one of the truly one of the most thoughtful, engaging interviews that I've done, and it's because you have a conversational style. Aww. I think that is so appealing to other people. I feel like I've been having, I've been sitting in my coffee room.
Well,
you know?
I know.
So thank you so much.
And we just we're missing some coffee and some snacks. We should have provided those. Right. But well, this is great. And I mean, it's so true, Tim. How we you know, our audience loves to see and hear from people who are real. And we're so looking, I mean, especially the 20-somethings today are looking for people that will inspire them and motivate them and give them hope that really there is something beyond themselves. And obviously, you know, we push the Lord here on the show 24/7 and who he is and what he can do in our lives. But it's great to see people who have taken that on as well.
I know we're supposed to conclude the interview, but let me just say in the last couple of seconds, not only do I completely agree with what you've just said, but it's why I've chosen to close the book in a chapter that's titled The Coming American Renaissance, mm-hmm. The Coming Rebirth of America. I do believe that, because I think faith in politics, faith in public life, we're a religious republic, to quote Michael Novak. We're a religious republic, and I believe that the Judeo-Christian tradition, though obscured right now, is alive and well. And I believe that in the Boundless generation, good things will come about. I do believe that.
All right. Well, check out the book, everyone. Again, The Man in the Middle, Practice Patriotism and Practice Repentance. Two lessons definitely learned within this interview. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks so much.